This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us for our radio Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. Many of us have had to adapt our work routines to accommodate the need to physically distance ourselves to help prevent the spread of COVID-19. For students and teachers, that meant moving from classrooms to online instruction. What about school counselors? How effective are they during distance learning? Watford City High School counselor Rachel Michael shared her experience with Tom Gerhardt, host of the Education Mindset podcast.
How are things in Watford City with the challenges of low oil prices and the change in how we're serving our education system? Give me a sense of how things are in the community.
Yeah, we kind of got hit with a double whammy. The COVID situation and the oil situation both happened at really close to the same time. So the oil prices severely impacted several of our families in our community. So of course, we're very worried about those students and their parents and how they're being affected by this. Some of our students who are already dealing with the stress of COVID now have parents who have been laid off, possibly moving back home. And so it's a lot of uncertainty in our community. One thing about Watford City is we've dealt with this before. We're pretty resilient and seem to usually bounce back. So I think we will.
That's funny. That's a word that I had next here, resiliency. I think it certainly speaks to Watford City. It also speaks, I think, to educators as a whole. Resiliency, the passion, the ability to innovate. I wanted, in a broad sense, before we get into maybe some of the finer details, for you just to tell me how challenging, both good and bad, this change has been in education, given the short window of time that everyone across the state and the nation, for that matter, has had to adjust.
This situation isn't something that any of us would have wanted or predicted. I have to say that no one went into education to sit by a computer all day. Missing the kids and the vibrancy of the school setting is a big disappointment. But I have to say that I've never been more proud of my coworkers and my fellow educators across the state. It's amazing to watch them. They've stepped up. They care so much. I think many of us are putting in more hours than we did before, if that's possible. And on top of the, you know, many of us are stay-at-home parents and dealing with other things too. But I just have to say that I still think the number one concern for our educators is our students and how are they doing and how can we help them. And we just wish we could do more. But it's really, I think, shown how awesome educators are as a whole.
And it's interesting that you mentioned that you may be putting in more time than lots of educators likely are. And I think those are some of the stories that I want to share so that the public, parents, lawmakers have a sense of exactly what is going on. Can you tell me just a little bit more about how maybe you are putting in more time or what you're seeing from your fellow educators in Watford City?
Communicating electronically is a little bit more inefficient. When you can see groups of students all at once, you're able to reach that many more students and they're there physically in the building. And I'm sure many people are finding this with their new version of their jobs where they're working from home, but it's just a slower process. You're trying to get more kids individually, spending more time tracking those kids down because they're not physically in front of you. And then also learning new systems. I mean, many of us hadn't used Zoom or various of Google platforms and different things that we're now using. And so the training for those platforms plus the kind of overall time commitment of reaching all these students is where I think that extra time is coming in now.
Since you just got done talking about Zoom and all of us trying to figure out technology, how has that gone for you?
Well, again, something like counseling and teaching, it's just a better fit when you're with the kids in person. And so that's been the biggest challenge. You miss seeing their faces and having those conversations in person. Especially our students who don't have the resources. That's been probably one of the biggest challenges is being able to, if they don't have internet or they're sharing computers with their siblings, or maybe they have one computer for the whole family, it becomes a challenge to reach the kids that we would usually be able to reach at school. But hearing from our students now is that much more rewarding just because we miss them. They miss us. I think they might not want to admit it, but I think they do. But when we do get to have those conversations, I've had Zoom sessions with students. It's awesome to see them and touch base with them and hear how they're doing and to also see their resiliency in the face of this new level of stress.
So what are some of the things that you're dealing with students?
I'm still doing many of the same things that I would be doing in the normal setting. A lot of academic and career planning, a lot of academic support, a lot of social emotional support, things like that. So I would say the general topics and issues that I'm dealing with are the same. But as anyone who's been watching the news would probably notice that there's been some extra discussion about mental health. Mm-hmm. In the face of this situation and this uncertainty, adults are feeling it. Students are feeling it. I mean, everyone's feeling it because this is not something that any of us have dealt with before. And so the level of anxiety and isolation is a major concern for our students right now, for adults too, but for our students, that's where we're having a lot of concerns is that I know more of our students are dealing with those issues right now. But I have less access to our students. So it's a concern, and we continuously talk amongst our colleagues about how can we address that? How can we send out resources, reach out to parents? So we've utilized a lot of creative methods to try to do that.
The anxiety and the isolation, I think, have to be the two most significant things I would think that you're facing that all of us have to deal with on some level.
You know, in this day and age, it seems that we have a little bit more students who deal with anxiety and depression than, for example, when I was younger. And I don't know if we just talk about it more, but it's a pretty significant issue amongst our teenagers today. And when you add in the isolation factor, it compounds those issues. So students who are typically they have tendencies towards anxiety or depression anyways, then when they're isolated all day, maybe their parents are working, or maybe they're in a home situation that's not ideal, then those circumstances can really compound the already existing mental health issues, or they can kind of bring on mental health issues for students who maybe didn't struggle with that terribly when they're busy and active and social. And it's a weird situation. I mean, I feel it too, for sure.
I have a son in college and a son in elementary school. And it's interesting to see how each is dealing with the isolation and at the different ages. And it's a challenge. And as you mentioned, it's a challenge for adults.
And we're social people. So it's taking away that school is a very social, it's 7 hours of nonstop social activity every day. So it's kind of ripping that away from us so suddenly is, like I said, not something any of us were really prepared for.
And the outlets that are typically available, whether it's sports or other activities that are offered by schools, I think prom, those types of things, graduation ceremonies, some things are still up in the air. But have you had to deal with any of those issues where people are having a difficult time because the sports seasons have been taken away, the extracurricular activities, the proms, graduation?
Absolutely, yes. And you know, when you look at the public health of our community, of course, that's going to take precedence over something like your baseball season. But those things are so, I did track and cross country in high school and college. And when track season came around, it was a fun time. I mean, the meets were fun. The practices were fun. It's a social thing. You are passionate about it. You put a lot of time into it. And especially for our seniors, I just feel so bad for them for having their seasons effectively canceled for now. So yeah, it's an issue, and maybe not as serious of an issue as a life or death situation, but a loss for sure. And something that our students have to grieve.
Are there other things that counselors are helping or dealing with students at this time?
We're still trying to do the normal things to help them prepare for the next step. So, for example, college, that's another thing that's kind of up in the air is kids are like, oh, should I, you know, still plan on going to NDSU or what should I do? So a little bit of uncertainty. We're still doing things like getting them access to scholarships. That's changed a little bit too, because it's It's all through distance now. Looking at class registration for next year, making plans, it's just a lot harder when we're all in our individual houses.
Right. Mm-hmm. How do you support students academically when they're learning independently? You're teaching through distance learning, you're counseling through distance. Unique challenges for sure.
Yep. So I've been doing a lot of checks on PowerSchool for their grades and then also things like credits. And I think I've written, I'm sure every educator is in the same boat, but I'm sure I've written hundreds of individual emails saying, hey, I've noticed, you know, you're not doing too well here. Can I help you? Setting up some Zoom sessions and then contacting parents whom I'm sure are kind of sick of hearing from us at this point, because we're ineffectively often using parents to try to reach their kids if we can't reach the kids through their school email. And so kind of following these different methods of communication and just hoping that one of them works and that we can talk to the kid.
Well, you mentioned parents and another point you brought up, what role does a family play in this time compared to, you know, how a family would typically engage with a student, their child during a school year?
I think the family has become a much bigger piece of the puzzle at this time. The family is always the most important piece of the puzzle, but when you drop your student off at the door at 7:45 in the morning and pick them up at 3:15, you're not seeing all the puzzle pieces that go on. So right now what we have is some families are embracing it and saying, you know, I'm going to do my best with this situation. Oh my gosh, teachers should get paid more. I'm sure you've seen those memes online. It's kind of a good feeling for educators. But then on the flip side, some parents, it's so overwhelming. If you have, like you said, several kids at home at different age levels, and you're trying to work from home and figure out all these apps and help your students manage their due dates and their assignments. And it's so overwhelming for some of our families that I truly do feel, I think some families are struggling with that situation with the education piece and probably a little bit sick of it. I know a couple of our families have kind of said, I think we're going to quit. So How can we keep helping them? And we've kind of stated, we're only going to assign two assignments per week and or two graded assignments, I should say. So we've kind of tried to ease up on our expectations too, but I do think it's a huge burden on the families to be doing all of the things that families usually do, plus now helping to educate their kids, which is our job. And we want to be there and do it, but we can't. So
do you support families in ways you typically wouldn't as well?
I think it's pretty similar. I think we just have a lot more communication with families because we're reaching out to them to try, like I said, try to get a hold of their kids and or help them with the platforms that we're using to deliver the education. And I have the high school level. So in my case, our students are pretty independent for the most part. They do know how to use Google Classroom. They've been using it all year. Watford City High School, I will say, was set up really nicely in that regard because we were already a one-to-one district and we were utilizing Google Classroom well before this happened. So for us, the transition was probably a little bit easier than for some other school districts. In that regard, it's nice that our students are familiar with those, but I still think that for those students who have kind of more or less dropped off the face of the earth, then we have to start bugging their parents.
Mm.
Yeah.
What do you miss about school being in session? It is in session, I guess. I shouldn't say it like that, but
traditional
school setting.
Oh my gosh, I'm a social person and I miss my coworkers and I miss seeing the students. I mean, seeing the students in person, they are so fun. They're funny. They're engaged. You know, everyone who's in education went into it for the students. So we miss them. And I think they miss us. I've had a few of them say, I never thought I'd say this, but I wish we were in school. So that's good.
I've heard several teachers, educators tell me that this has been an emotional time. Speak to that a little bit. Obviously, just getting a little bit more into those connections. I mean, the bonds, if anything has come out of this, I would hope, and I work in the education field on the periphery, I guess, but that there's a better understanding of what educators do. And I would say respect and admiration and all those things hopefully come to the forefront when we look at the jobs that you and others do day in and day out across the state and the nation for our kids and our communities. But talk about the emotions that you've experienced.
It's been very emotional. I work closely with our seniors. I love our senior class. I say that every year, but to think about the possibility that we might not be back together again. We're hoping to hold some kind of graduation ceremony at some point, but the last couple of months of the year are always an exciting and stressful and crazy time. But to think about not seeing that group of students together, that's sad. And then with some of our students who are likely moving with the drop of the oil, that's also a kind of a stressful thing. And I have felt that kind of heaviness at home. And I just wish so badly. I think that it's given us all a little bit of a perspective too, in terms of, you know, sometimes I come home so exhausted because I have talked to 200 students that day, but I don't know, maybe this will make me appreciate that exhaustion more next year, because I would do anything to have that back.
Well, I'm glad you brought up next year, because another question I had is, I mean, right now we're in the middle of this. Well, I don't know if anybody knows anything for certain, but at least for the school year, depending upon what happens moving forward. But there are some positives that can come out of this, that will come out of this, that have come out of this, right? I mean, even looking toward next year, being forced into the situation, I think certainly will help us in education with our students, our families, with use of technology. That should be a big positive, I would think.
Yeah, it's kind of forced us to grow and adapt, and that's always a good thing. And so even with some of the platforms that I mentioned, we've been forced to learn them, but they'll only give us more tools in the future when we are back together. And I think it's forced some innovation that was maybe slower at happening. It's really sped that up. And like I said, even just the maybe not taking for granted what a blessing it is to be in a public school system or any school system is, all of this can only benefit us, but it's hard right now.
Well, I'll just give you an opportunity for some final thoughts. And I wanted to circle back to your beginning statement, just talking about the pride that you have in the education system in Watford City. I think it probably extends to the families and students that are all trying to do their best during this situation, and certainly across the state, as you mentioned, seeing all of us trying to do our best to get through all of this. Just a final thought on that and ending on a good note.
You know, I'm part of several online groups for counselors and educators and different Facebook groups and things like that. And I have to say that I have seen nothing but concern and care for our students. And everyone is out there asking questions. How do I do this for our students in this weird time? Or how do we reach out to our seniors? Or how do we help kids with their mental health during this time? What are you all doing? And so just seeing all of those ideas bouncing off each other, I think educators have always been good collaborators, but this has highlighted that and how much we rely on each other and how much we care about our students. And I just, like I said, I just could not be prouder of my fellow educators and counselors, teachers, principals, all of it, nurses, you know, the custodians. Every piece of the school puzzle has been highlighted during this in terms of the roles that we play. And I just think we're doing our best, and hopefully that's recognized. But if it's not, we're going to keep doing our best. It's just what educators do.
That was Tom Gerhart, host of the Education Mindset Podcast, in a discussion with Watford City High School counselor Rachel Michael. Next on Main Street, Tom Ezern.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Tom Ezern is a professor and student of the history of the Great Plains. He shares what he has learned in his Plains Folk essays, a regular feature on Main Street. Today's essay reveals a lesser-known facet of North Dakota history and is titled, sheep country.
There is a curious gap in our historical memory as to the culture of sheep on the northern plains. We'd love to tell the story of the range cattle industry, although we recognize it was a transitory enterprise and generally date its demise sometime around the hard winter of 1887. We like to think there was a ready transition from the open range to modern ranching. We are loath to admit that, in fact, the range cattle industry failed and was replaced, for the better part of a generation, by the sheep industry. So let us converse for a moment with A.T. Packard, the gingery editor of the Badlands Cowboy of Medora in early 1884. We find him contemplating the failure of the sheep-raising initiative of the Marquis de Moray, and insisting, in the heart of cattle country, that the Badlands is a sheep country, if the right kind of sheep are bred. The Marquis failed because he shipped in his sheep too late in the fall, and sheep need to get acquainted with the range earlier in the season, Packard said. In time, Packard predicted, sheep will undoubtedly prove as remunerative in the Badlands as cattle. Or more so, and not only in the West River, but also in the Missouri Coteau, the hill country east of the Missouri River. In 1882, as recounted in a letter to the Bismarck Tribune in 1888, Alexander Campbell and Sons, operating at Glencoe, Emmons County, decided to invest in sheep. We formed the opinion that this part of Dakota was well adapted for sheep raising, Campbell recounts. This, on account of the abundance of rich pasturage for 9 months of the year, the comparative cheapness with which hay could be put up, the dryness of the soil, the plentifulness of water, the absence of long continuing rains, and the convenience of timber for building sheds. The reason Campbell mentions dry soil and the lack of long rainy spells was the common problem of foot rot in flocks around the world. In triumph, Campbell continues, last winter, 1887, the worst on stock ever experienced in the West, the loss from November to April in 1800 head wintered at Goose Lake was 23 head. In 500 wintered at Glencoe, the loss was 6 head. Besides making net returns on wool of $1.18 a head, the Campbell's sheep had not required dipping, as scab or parasites of any kind are so far unknown. Here, the pioneering pastoralist refers to another global issue with flocks, the pandemic of scab, a parasitic infection of the sheep's skin. Dakota is a sheep country, declared Campbell, even with her natural grasses, and would be even better with the establishment of improved pastures, especially bluegrass, which has so far done finely. By end of 1890, sheep farmer H.C. Ayers was confirming to the Jamestown Weekly Alert the superiority of the Dakotas, specifically including North Dakota, to any other country in the world for raising sheep. The soil, he attested, was usually dry and affords good footing. The environment was one of robust health for man and beast. Pasturage was practically unlimited, water abundant, there was local grain for feeding out mutton beasts to be shipped to St. Paul, Duluth, Chicago, Omaha. Was this simply hopeful rhetoric? Well, not at all. In May 1892, a correspondent of the Dickinson Press made a careful reconnaissance of farms and ranches around New England and all along the Cannibal River. All of them kept scores of cattle, but they had hundreds or thousands of sheep. The historic character of North Dakota as a sheep country has been our little secret for more than a century. It's time we fessed up to it.
That's Tom Ezern. Coming up on Main Street, a Harvest Public Media report about the pandemic's effect on rural grocery stores. And Sue Balcom with Main Street Eats. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota's COVID-19 death toll has risen to 57 after one more individual passed away with the novel coronavirus. The patient was a man in his 80s from Cass County. He had underlying health conditions. 42 new individuals from six counties have also tested positive for COVID-19. 36 were from Cass County, two were from Burley County. Grand Forks, Richland, Trail, and Ward counties all reported one new case. The positive results were from a pool of 1,978 tests for a positive rate of 2.1%. A total of 2,481 people have tested positive overall. 35 people are currently hospitalized with COVID-19. There have been 161 total hospitalizations. There have been 1,793 recoveries. This leaves 631 active confirmed cases. Governor Burgum has signed an executive order suspending a state law that limits the amount of the school district's unobligated ending general fund balance. That's due to school districts receiving some CARES Act money and the cancellation of some school events because of COVID-19. The law says school districts can have up to 35% of their money in that ending balance. Any amount over that would be paid back to the state's general fund. State School Superintendent Kirsten Basler says this will help local districts as they plan for the next school year.
We didn't want to put our school districts, our school superintendents, and or our school boards in the really uncomfortable position of maintaining the compliance with the North Dakota Century Code and making sure that they were spending down their general fund, which is essentially the fund that is obligated for salaries and or programs and professional development.
The amount of carryover money some school districts have had has been a source of some controversy in the legislature, but Basler says she worked with lawmakers on this to make sure they understood.
The common objective for all of us was to make sure that our school districts would have the funds that were necessary in order for them to do the intended purpose of educating our students, whether that be the last 9 weeks of this school year or as we delay that into next school year.
The State Industrial Commission will consider funding a project to capture and store carbon dioxide for ethanol production. The project would be at the site of the Blue Flint Ethanol Plant, which is close to the Great River Energy Coal Creek Station. The power plant will be closing by 2022. Public Service Commissioner Randy Chrisman is a member of the Renewable Energy Council, which has signed off on the project. He says cores would be drilled to see if they could store CO2.
It's an interesting project and potentially has long-term benefit to the lignite industry in that it could entice a potential buyer of the Great River Energy Plant to be more interested than they would be otherwise.
But Chrisman says he's concerned that nearly half of the money for the project would come from the council.
If the plan follows as GRE has laid out and that coal mine and plant cease, the LRC is going to need their resources to work with the coal industry that remains, I think.
So Chrisman says he made a motion in the LRC to add a contingency, so if a future fuel source for the plant is switched away from lignite in the next 5 years, the money would be paid back. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. At the start of the pandemic, grocery store aisles were crowded and shelves emptied of basic items. To avoid the mayhem, some shoppers turned to smaller markets in more rural areas. As Harvest Public Media's Dana Cronin reports, that's given rural grocery stores a boost.
Winchester, Illinois is a town of fewer than 2,000 people. Great Scott Community Market opened in an old shoe store there less than a year ago. Before then, the nearest grocery store was about 20 miles away.
Where a previous owner sold shoes, we've got our dried goods and canned goods and all the grocery staples that you find in any grocery store.
Market President John Paul Coonrod says they also sell your standard craft beer, wine, and frozen foods and have a deli section in back. Since the pandemic started, he says business has been booming with sales through the roof for the first 10 days.
After that, we've settled into a pretty good stasis of sales that are about double, I would say, what they were pre-COVID.
Coonrod says he usually recognizes most of his customers. Lately, though, he says it's been a lot of unfamiliar faces, and there could be any number of reasons for that. For one, due to lockdown orders, people who live in rural areas like Winchester aren't traveling as much into urban areas for work and are likely choosing to shop closer to home. Robin Lyons would usually shop at the Kroger 20 miles away, but now frequents Gray Scott.
this is the time, because these are our neighbors and our fellow townspeople, and so we got to shop local.
The appeal of smaller grocery stores might also be driving city dwellers into more rural areas, says Shannon McCord, who owns Ideal Market in Superior, Nebraska.
Of course, Walmarts are always packed with people.
He says that makes it hard for customers to socially distance.
So I think they decided to stay local, which it would end up doing is causing my store to be packed with people.
He says he's seen a 20 to 30% increase in sales since the start of the pandemic. Business is so busy, in fact, that he's completely burnt out.
It's been tremendously difficult. I've been putting in super long hours.
McCord says he's been working 70 or 80 hours a week, mostly on inventory.
I've been doing that for 10 weeks straight.
Supply chain disruptions have made it hard to keep items like meat, flour, and toilet paper in stock. But in many cases, smaller grocery stores have found workarounds by turning to their local communities. After meatpacking plant closures, for example, McCord started working to pair area hog farmers with local butchers in hopes of keeping his meat case stocked. And at Great Scott Community Market in Illinois, it was flour that was in short supply.
We're a small grocery store, and we're absolutely at the bottom of the supply chain. You know, we'll be the last ones to get something if it's scarce.
So Coonrod decided to buy and repackage flour from local restaurants so he could sell it off his own shelves. Ryle Carver with Kansas State University's Rural Grocery Initiative says this is a good example of how these stores can adapt in difficult situations. According to Carver, more than 20% of rural grocery stores in Kansas closed between 2008 and 2018. When one closes, she says it can hit a community hard.
And often the folks that are hit the hardest are the older adults in the community and the lower income individuals in the community who may not have the means or the capacity to get to a further away grocery store.
As stay-at-home orders begin to loosen, rural grocery store owners hope their new customers will continue to shop local. I'm Dana Cronin, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a reporting collaborative that looks at farm and rural issues. You can follow their reporting at harvestpublicmedia.org. Next on our show, Main Street Eats.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by North Dakota Living, celebrating more than 65 years of featuring the great people and places of North Dakota and proudly serving the members of North Dakota's electric cooperatives.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and joining me now is root cellar Sue. Sue Balcom joins us once a week from her farm outside of Mandan, the root cellar's farm, to talk about food. Sue, thanks for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here, Ashley. Although I think I'd probably rather be out in the garden.
Yeah. You didn't get enough of that over Memorial Day weekend?
Oh, no. You know, I work probably about 2 hours in the morning before I go to my regular job, and then 2 hours when I get home. But the morning's the best. Gorgeous, the sun shining, and we've had pretty good warm, balmy mornings and little dewdrops here and there. And this is my favorite time of the year.
So you've been in the garden, and what are you planting?
Oh my gosh, I'm so excited. You know, we've expanded our gardens this year, and I just put in about 84 tomatoes, 50-foot row of beans, 100 feet of cucumbers. I've got like 50 cabbages. I'm just like so stinking excited.
I have 2 cabbages.
Oh, okay. I have Chinese and red and storage cabbage because of sauerkraut. But I was talking to my friend who is my garden mentor, if you can believe that. Everybody needs a good garden mentor. And she of all people, she's been gardening for decades as a market gardener, whereas I've just been gardening in my own little world. And I want to bust out of that. And she mentioned to me that she does companion planting.
Yeah.
And I just went, what? I have read about companion planting. And I used to abide by that back in the days when I was a young housewife in the early 80s, reading every organic gardening magazine that, you know, front to back, like getting outside. I converted the whole backyard into raised beds. My next door neighbor was awesome. He was an elderly man that also gardened, and I learned things from him. In the middle of winter, I would go outside to say goodbye to my husband on the way to work, and here would be these footprints on the sidewalk, the fresh snow, you know, and footprints on the sidewalk. And I'm like, oh, I better go shovel. And I'd step outside, and here there would be packets of radishes and lettuce under my doormat, because he was such an encourager. It was so awesome, except for when he crushed cans at 4 o'clock in the morning. He recycled.
You win some, you lose some.
I know, right?
So companion planting is the concept of some plants like to be planted near other plants?
That is correct. Okay. And there is this great book called Carrots Love Tomatoes. And it was written by Louise Riotti, and she's from Oklahoma. And, you know, it talks about things like garlic and peas don't like each other. And so you never want to plant your garlic next to your peas, even though I have done that before. But there are complementary plants, and then there are plants that just kind of don't like each other and they don't do as well. I don't know if you have grandparents or anybody that you recall always planted marigold borders as insect deterrent.
Yeah.
Borders around gardens. And so I've learned that you can do that, but it's best to do it. You have to do it continually, and you should do it year after year for it to be effective. Now, another way to do this to confuse pests with marigolds is to interplant rows of marigolds and other vegetables. Insects and birds and deer, they look for the largest grouping of plants. Like if you have a whole field full of corn, they're gonna go, look at that, we can eat for, you know, 3 months on that one field of corn. Whereas if you, like, let's say this is the flea beetle time of year. In the spring, the flea beetles come out. And if you've ever had a beautiful row of spinach or lettuce, and all of a sudden it's black, and then the next day it's gone, that was probably flea beetles. And so in order to keep the flea beetles off of your cabbages, your broccolis, they like bitter greens, mustard greens, lettuce, things like that, you would plant your cabbages, and then on either side you'd plant something tender like a mustard green or a leaf lettuce. They'll go for the easiest meal, and they're temporary. They're only here for a short time. And then they move on or die or go to the canola fields is what I think they do. So you plant these succulent, soft bitter greens next to your cabbages, and they'll go for the soft stuff and leave your cabbages alone.
Sure.
And another thing is, like, if you're a culinary expert or a culinary experimenter, you know that there are certain vegetables that go well together.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like tomatoes and basil. Everybody loves tomatoes and basil.
Yes.
So naturally, they like each other in the garden also.
Mm. Well, and basil is repelling aphids, is that right?
It repels, what doesn't like basil? Aphids or maybe other
something
tiny insects?
Something that likes tomatoes.
Right, because basil has this distinct smell, which I don't like to eat basil, but I really like the smell of it. Mm. So I grow all kinds of basils. And this book, Carrots Love Tomatoes, she has each of these herbs and each of the vegetables kind of like outlined here. And then it says what they do and do not like. And there's herbs and things that you can grow to actually attract pollinators to your garden, which is also important. But basil, like getting back to basil, yes, it keeps insects and some diseases away from tomatoes. So you want to grow them parallel to tomatoes rather than in between, because they kind of create a barrier, you know, from there. But did you know that you can also, when you cut up tomatoes in the summertime, or you have tomatoes in your house when you harvest them, they have those little tiny fruit flies that kind of show up that are a real annoyance to my husband. But they're temporary, so I'm always just laying out cider vinegar and then they drown. But you can lay basil leaves over a over your tomatoes to help keep those insects away, those fruit flies away from those tomatoes as you're waiting to can them.
Does little to keep humans away, though.
Oh my gosh, I know. Like I said, I don't like basil, but boy, when we were young, tomatoes were like a bedtime snack. And we used to put sugar over them because, as you know, a tomato is a fruit and not a vegetable.
Right.
So in the morning, you eat salt on them. In the afternoons, you eat sugar on them, and then you're good to go. Carrots actually are good for tomatoes also, and beans and lettuce. So carrots apparently have some kind of magic to them. So I'm going to plant carrots in every available little space that I got this year just to see what happens. You don't, however, want to not harvest those carrots because they will grow and produce seed. They're a biennial plant. They don't produce seed the first year, but if you leave them in the ground, they'll come up and they kind of look like Queen Anne's lace because they're a relative of Queen Anne's lace. So then they'll seed themselves, and pretty soon you're going to have carrots growing in every crack in your sidewalk. So don't let them go. Now, when you're planting your cucumbers, you can put in a couple of radish seeds. And I have always allowed my radishes to go to seed, the ones that we don't eat, you know, when they get woody, when it gets warm. I leave them in the ground. A, they're good for the soil, and B, when they bloom, they also deter some pests. But you can eat those little seed pods. They are fantastic.
Yeah, I discovered that last year when I had just ignored my radishes for long enough, and then my friend Thor was like, you know, you can eat those, right?
Oh, man. I'm thinking that we can eat just about, everything green in the garden. Yeah, so I'm going to start doing that.
Yeah.
I did when I was a kid. I know I did.
Yeah. Well, I was in the yard and I was, you know, picking through some things. And I was like, oh, man, I don't know what this is, but it smells good. I'm going to eat it. And it tasted really kind of peppery and sort of lovely. I was like, oh, this is great. But then like an hour later, I looked over and my cat, Sophie, was in that same spot. And
oops.
Her territory.
Oops.
I'm like, seriously? Okay, so rinse. You can eat it from the garden, but still rinse
Oh, that's hilarious.
And of course, we've got the famous three sisters.
Yes, I was just going to say, now let's go back to before people even had books. There was something intuitive about how the Native Americans planted their gardens. Everybody, well, maybe not everybody, but you and I for sure know what a three sisters garden is.
Corn, squash, and beans.
Yep, corn, squash, and beans. And not only do they create a nutrient-rich dish when cooked together, there was a reason they did that. They didn't have fences back then. And so these plants grew symbiotically to deter pests and weeds. You know, like the beans crawled up the corn stalks and produced. And then, of course, squash. Raccoons do not like squash plants. So if you do plant a large patch of corn, plant your squash around the outer perimeter to keep the raccoons, hopefully, away from your corn. And that was one of the things that happened with the three sisters thing.
Yeah. And well, and then one is nitrogen hogging and one is nitrogen replacing, too.
Correct. I think the beans and, the corn uses the nitrogen and the beans actually put the nitrogen back in the soil.
Yeah.
They're nitrogen fixers is, I think, the proper term.
And if I'm not mistaken, you can actually plant all three of those just in the same hole, right?
Correct.
That's so amazing.
And they will come up. I usually, you know, it's kind of like when the back of your seed packet says plant a hill of beans. They don't necessarily mean that you create a hill. It's just a term used for that little tiny 6-inch diameter space that you're planting those seeds in. So, you know, you'd put the corn in the center of your circle and then you would probably do beans and squash around the outside.
Okay.
And it's attractive. You know, it's like I see these movies and I look at these gardens and
you know, during the Depression years, and their cabbages are lined up straighter than soldiers, and there isn't a stinking weed in between those rows. And trust me, people, when I tell you, that is just about as imaginary as the movie you're watching. That's not what they look. That's not what anybody's garden looks like.
Well, it's not what they're supposed to look like. That's not how nature works.
Right. And I have dreams of that. I have dreams of someday having this perfectly weed-free, gorgeous garden, but when people ask me about that, they're like, oh yeah, let's see, what do you use to plant straight rows? And I'm like, I don't think God plants it a straight row, so why should I? It's more fun to be a little dizzy, but my husband won't let me mow the lawn now because I don't mow in a straight line. I do circles and I write words, you know. And I,
oh, wow.
And he's like, yeah, you're not mowing the lawn with the tractor anymore.
You are where crop circles come from.
That's exactly you
hear,
right.
You heard it here first. Investigative journalism right here on Main Street. Well, Sue, as always, it's been a pleasure.
I just love this time with you, Ashley. You've become a very good friend to me, and I appreciate that a lot.
What an honor that is to hear. Thank you so much.
The U.S. Army is getting back to business next month, and combat training will look a lot different.
If you noticed all the cots that are crossed here, they're 6 feet spacing now.
Their biggest concern, how quickly they can turn around a virus test.
Right now, 144 a day, and the capacity that we want to get to is 1,000 a day.
The Army adjusts to COVID-19 on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
Prairie Public's Main Street features voices who've been with us for years. Chuck Lura's voice is particularly familiar. His natural North Dakota essays have been heard on our network for longer than I've been here. He's a former biology teacher who loves to share the wonders of our natural world. Today, his subject is the clay-colored sparrow.
Take a walk across the mixed grass prairies of North Dakota during the spring and summer, and you're likely to hear a series of short buzzing sounds emanating from a patch of western snowberry or perhaps a thicket of some other shrubs. You may associate this buzzing with some type of an insect, but it isn't. It's the song of a clay-colored sparrow. Here it is again. Clay-colored sparrows are among the most numerous songbirds of the northern prairie shrub communities. Their breeding range runs roughly from Montana eastward to the Great Lakes states, as well as in southern Manitoba and much of Saskatchewan and Alberta. Here in North Dakota, they can be found across the state where they prefer the native mixed grass prairie with scattered shrubs such as patches of western snowberry or thickets of silverberry, chokecherry, juneberry, buffaloberry, and rose. Although you may be commonly hearing this bird, seeing it's a bit more difficult. Unlike many grassland birds where the males seek out the highest perch to announce their presence and defend their territory, the male clay-colored sparrows choose to do their announcing from the lower branches of shrubs. Look for these high-octane feather balls flitting close to the ground, where they feed mainly on seeds. Clay-colored sparrows have been described as slender and trim. They're pale tan and gray with a small bill. Look for a pale gray collar, which is a key characteristic in identification. And of course, if you hear one singing, the identification will be confirmed. As you might expect, these birds nest in shrubs. Nests are generally located about a foot above the ground and well protected among the lower branches. The nest is small, a bit less than 2 inches across and slightly less deep, and is composed of twigs and grasses. For finishing touches, the cup is lined with grass and perhaps some hair. They'll produce 1 to 2 broods each summer with an incubation time of 10 to 14 days and a nesting period of 7 to 9 days. Although the clay-colored sparrow is still commonly observed in our prairies, they have declined by 51% from 1966 to 2015 in the United States. That's probably due to habitat loss and fragmentation. Plus, cowbirds are also known to parasitize their nests, thus reducing their reproductive output. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can read and hear today's story at prairiepublic.org.
This is Dakota Daybook for May 28th.
Dickinson had been established as Pleasant Valley Siding in 1880, but the name changed by 1881. It became the county seat in 1883, incorporated in 1899, and became a city in 1900. And on this date, in 1909, Dickinson was abuzz with an idea proposed by Mr. James C. Young to the city council on how to speed up development in the city. James Young of Minneapolis had been an owner of the town site, one of around 100 town sites he owned at one time. He also worked on railroads, trolley lines, and had interest in electrical systems and power generation. And he had a big plan to push Dickinson forward, a plan called somewhat overwhelming in its magnitude. He proposed that a, quote, monster million-dollar company, unquote, that might own all the utilities imaginable, all the electric, light, power, gas, waterworks, and trolley franchises of Dickinson. This included a central heating system that would supply heat for all of the city's businesses and homes, an electric light and power system, expansion possibilities for the city waterworks, a telephone company, and more. Citizens would have a chance to become stockholders, and a percentage of the money raised could be turned over to the city. Young also said he was considering a residential building association. He spoke for about an hour and a half at a public meeting as citizens of Dickinson listened, and it was reported that there was not a one who was not impressed with the fact that the speaker was sincere in all his ideas and that many of his suggestions could be carried out with a material benefit to the growth of Dickinson, unquote. He needed to get some assistance to make these goals a reality, however, and was hoping that his ideas would garner the support of about 15 to 20 men who could support and push forward his ideas. He had many more, and even worked to offer options for extending the water system, offering to aid in some way if it was done within the year. Young believed that the heroes of the country were, quote, those in everyday walks of life, the pioneers who built the country's prosperity. The Dickinson Press noted, it has its feasible suggestions, and there is but little doubt that with men like Mr. Young and his associates, with the cooperation of Dickinson's keenest businessmen and citizens behind the proposition, it would be a material factor in the rapid growth of the city and would hasten what is bound to happen in time, the development of Dickinson as the great metropolis of western North Dakota. Today's Dakota Datebook, written by Sarah Walker. I'm Bill Thomas.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We hope you've enjoyed today's Main Street. Tomorrow on our show, we'll hold our monthly journalist roundtable. Prairie Public News Director Dave Thompson is a roundtable regular, and joining us will be special guests Amy Dalrymple, editor of the Bismarck Tribune, and Dave Kolpak with the Associated Press. And film reviewer Matt Olean will report on the outlook for an Academy Awards ceremony amid a pandemic. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Friday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.